this is the first time we may have come here. We're absolutely pleased to be having this discussion, which is a very special opportunity because Harold Jacobson just happens to be in country this week. This is part of the exhibition Out of the Archive, so if you haven't had a chance to see it, this has been an exhibition and project that's been working with a series of four artists who've been drawing on the collections of the library. And in particular this case, Marisha has been working with the Green and Common Women's Peace Campaign material, and as part of that she's produced a particular project called Open Hearing, and as part of that it's been triggering a public debate around legal responses to the Green and Women's campaign. So this is going to be an opportunity to hear a bit about that. If you haven't had a chance to actually go into the listening booth, this has been created and there's an opportunity to see the film that's been produced by Tim Nock, and that's called And the Fence Came Tumbling Down, and that alternates with a soundtrack that kind of recites some of the court cases around the campaign. We're also delighted to have Carol Jacobson here, and she's an award-winning social documentary artist and has worked in video installation and photography, particularly in looking at issues around women's criminalisation, human rights and censorship. The two films we're going to be looking at tonight is Time Like Zeroes and Excerpts from Clemency, which have been narrated by women prisoners. So there is some more information that Carol has also given out about some of the articles she's written, and there's some background to both Carol and Marisha on the handouts, so do take an opportunity to look at those. And I shall now hand over to Marisha and Carol, so if you could join me in welcoming them.
Thank you. Thank you, Shandan. And I would like to thank the Women's Library for extending the invitation to Carol to be here tonight. It was, I wanted to tell you a little bit how this happened, why we are here tonight. Maybe I should start, it's a shame that Anna Collin, who is the curator of the project Out of the Archives, cannot be here. She is being interviewed for a research fellowship in Holland. So I think it's really through her and through your invitation as the Women's Library to her to try and think of the archive as a resource for artists and to reanimate the materials that are here. So when Anna approached me to think of a possible project looking at what is here, it just coincided with the time when I was looking at the 1980s, which is exactly the time when I came here from Poland. And what interested me was to try and see how the events of, well, at that time, the Cold War, and also the fact that, you know, 1981 was the moment of introduction of martial law in Poland, and that is the very same year when Greenham began. So for me it was an interest to kind of connect that moment in my biography of coming from one kind of political system to another, and also to find out and to, well, to kind of establish a relationship to a time when I began to practice here as an artist. And in fact, I began to practice by making recordings of conversations with women, which are now 25 years later, because it's really, you know, I was doing this in 1985, are collected in this website, which is called Women's Audio Archive. So there was also my history in trying to trace what is possible to do for an artist in a culture that for me was foreign. And conversation seemed to me like a good point to start. So that's really why, well, that's the reason why I looked at Greenham, and also because at that time a couple of friends of mine took me to visit the camp, so I had this kind of first-hand experience. But in the end, the research that I undertaken also with kind of two assistants, one of them is here, Helen Kaplinski, and Giada Consoli, they really looked at all the materials related to Greenham, and there is a huge amount and a very kind of rich resource. I wasn't so interested in trying to do something that in fact someone else has fairly recently done so much better. And that's the website put together by Beban Kidron, who is also a filmmaker and who made a famous film, Bring Greenham Home. She made a website which is www.yourgreenham.co.uk in collaboration with The Guardian and I think maybe Channel 4. And that is the most amazing resource for materials that are archival but are available in this online way. So I didn't really want to reproduce that. But the one thing that I've noticed was lacking in this website, or maybe less represented, was this question of, the legal questions and the relationship to law. And that's something that I also come to it from a different point, which is really how the language of the law was used and also how we know so little about it. Because unless you read the transcripts of the trials and the court proceedings, that language is to most of us not really available because most of us are not really participating in any court hearings. So that was pretty what I tried to concentrate on, to kind of recover the voice of the women and the legal profession and to kind of confront them. And the recordings that you hear as part of the cinema and as part of that sequence is really just that. It's just kind of trying to hear what was said at the time and what were the arguments. But it is also something else that I hope we will discuss in a little while, is this question of which Greenham women very much argue for in their defense in those legal cases, is the question of the commons. And of course that, 28 years ago, was somewhere else than it is for us now. And the commons has kind of come back as an issue, not just to do with land and kind of property rights, but also to do with digital commons. So for me, it's also this kind of conceptual leap between the idea of what you need to defend as part of a shared culture, and now what we also need to defend, which is access to archives, which are very often very, very hard to access digitally, at least. So it kind of brings these two things together for me. When I was researching, Anna sent me, Anna Collin, the curator, has sent me this PDF, which was what you have here, except that it was in this rather murky form. And it's really while reading this that I kind of confirmed this interest and commitment to concentrate on the legal issues. And I was very, very inspired, especially as this article begins with a quotation from Doris Lessing, where she really talks about the responsibility of the artist. And that's something that, again, I'd like to talk to you in a minute. Mm-hmm. So that question is hovering, I think, around the whole project, not just my project, but also all the three other artists involved in the Out of the Archives. And it's also about kind of relationship that anything that we do has with media. So Greenham, as you know, was a very It was the case where the media was very cruel and very interfering in the whole process. So I think that's something that's interesting. But where you begin this, you actually say that the Greenham Peace Camp, the Women's Peace Camp, is a work of art. And I think that has to be really my first question to you in relation to at least my project. I would then like you to narrate everything that you want to say about your films that we're going to see tonight. But I think that that's a very important question, how you come to think that. And also maybe even before that, tell us a little bit about what were you doing in Britain as an American artist, feminist, in at that time, and when did you come here and why?
Well, I came to Europe living in London and France with my then partner, and I was, the first thing was that I was struck by the miles and miles of military cemeteries across northern France and Belgium. I mean, I just was just dumbstruck. And I thought, we don't live with that in the US. We don't see that in our landscape. And I couldn't believe the reminders of two world wars that are evident everywhere here. And, you know, and French farmers and Belgian farmers getting blown up every summer when they tilled the fields still from unexploded bombs and so on. And I got very depressed about it. And then I began to document. I photographed in every cemetery, and that was about 50 or 60 cemeteries that I went to, and wrote down names and dates of death of soldiers and from the world wars, and photographed in those cemeteries and so on. At the same time, I began to read in the newspaper about Greenham and the peace camp that was going on. This was 83. Okay. And it was the sort of counter that lifted my spirits. and I said, oh, I have to go. And so I came to London, and I was trying to figure out where exactly it was, and I was going back and forth, living sometimes in London and sometimes in northern France. And then a friend came over from the US, and so I said, I really want to go to this place and find it. I was always like going on forays to find like Katha Colwitz's grave, of her son's grave from World War I, and her sculptures that are overlooking her son's grave and those kinds of things. Anyway, we went and we spent a day walking around and sitting and having tea and talking to women and looking at the fence and photographing and I also, before I went and after I went, came to the Fawcett Library, and that's where I was finding, you know, newspaper articles from the previous 2 years from when Greenham first started. And so I was able to sort of give myself some grounding in it and what had gone on and who participated and what events had already taken place and so on, and know about it enough to then go and then come back and go through the files again. And that was a wonderful resource. And so then I was just really moved to make a whole body of work, really, that was kind of, that I called the Greenham Project. It was a number of installations. One was a large video installation that included all the photographs of the military cemeteries, one after the other, after the other. And that installation, I mean, I have to admit, I regret still. I mean, I'm really, I love it when artists and people tell you about their mistakes. So I'll tell you about my mistake. I mean, I made this huge installation and the Detroit Art Institute paid for it, commissioned it. But it was, and I was like so driven to do it after being here and being so angry about the war machine and the nuclear weapons and so on, that I was just really driven to do this installation. And what it was 400 human bones that I bought. Well, the Detroit Art Institute bought them, actually. And I hand-engraved each one with the name and date of death of a soldier that I had written down from all the cemeteries. And they were installed in a room with the video projection going of one after another. So that was the installation. Now I look back and I think, oh my God, how did I... That was really unconscionable. How could I have done that? Even though I cried over every bone that... Anyway, so I feel really horrified that I made that piece. And yet, artists sometimes... I mean, we take risks. We do things that we do regret afterwards and are, you know that it was over the line. And yet we do push boundaries, and I could see the women at Greenham pushing boundaries, and it gave me so much courage. And I felt so emboldened by what they were doing, breaking into the fence, crawling over, crawling under, dancing on the missile silos, and it did. I mean, I have always felt that was a really catalyst, a moment, and it was a moment for thousands of women. Greenham was. I mean, some of my best friends today are artists who were at Greenham. And when I went back to the U.S., I wrote this article, and I connected with several women who had been there, New York artists, and we did a sort of homage to Greenham in New York City. We did a storefront window called Window Peace, and one woman a week sat in that window for about 9 months. So I sat in that window with my bones and talked to people, came in and out of the window. So I lived in that window a week, night and day, and didn't leave it. And that's what each artist did. One woman a week lived in that window, and it went on for about 9 months. It was organized by Susan Kleckner and Paula Allen in New York. And Paula is still one of my closest friends, and she is a fabulous photographer in New York City whose work focuses on outsider groups of women around the world. She's an amazing artist photographer. So,
but I will stop you here, yeah, just to maybe try and come back to this question, What were you really thinking when you proposed that Greenham as a work of art? Because I think, you know, this is something that now there's always this uneasy relationship between art and activism. And for a lot of people, work that is political and kind of overtly engaging politics often is the work that is kind of slightly cast aside, because the art world also demands of us to maybe not to be so kind of engaged with politics in such an overt way. So I wonder, you know, for me it's a very convincing argument that it's not really talking about aesthetics, it's about talking about taking a position. But I wonder what were you thinking, saying that it is a work of art?
I guess I saw it as a holistic group project. And I remember thinking it through and thinking about conceptualizing the whole thing, but it was, to me, greater than the sum of its parts, greater than the individual actions that had happened there. The whole thing was a group collective effort, and it was visible in the world, and it was startling and inspiring, and it was drawing audiences and women from all over the world. And I saw it as a really amazing activist art project that anyone could plug into and participate in at whatever level they wanted to, and take away inspiration, motivation, the feeling that they could carry that away.
So I was actually thinking, in while researching and coming across various printed matter from the time, from posters to newsletters to postcards and various communications, what was it like to organize such an amazing movement around this cause before internet? Because obviously now, you know, we are all the time connected and everything is visible.
Yeah.
And I thought what was interesting in the article that you've written is that this is where the courts kind of come into being. It's because a lot of the proceedings or some aspect of the proceedings was always reported by the media. So in fact, it's through the sort of mainstream media, and although it was not a very favorable publicity, nevertheless, it was still publicity that something was happening. So I wonder, you know, because that's probably the time where, not just here, but maybe in your other experiences, this kind of, you know, how does the movement operate in terms of organization with those kind of older forms of communication?
At the time, I think I learned about telephone trees.
Okay.
The women were implementing telephone trees. And I don't think I'd heard that term before I came in the early 80s. And that's the way the women were communicating a lot at that time. But yes, the media, it has a double edge because it gave publicity to what was happening at Greenham, and especially their big events with thousands of women. But of course, it also trivialized and belittled them as wild and crazy women and bald-haired women and so on and so forth, and homophobic stuff and all kinds of negative publicity. I get that. I deal with that too in today, in working with women in prison, trying to get them out and wanting publicity for them, because sometimes you can get a sympathetic reporter who will write a sympathetic article, but a lot of times they have to go to the prosecutors who call them, you know, a black widow or a or some horrible name, and so you get both, and it's hard to take. It's very hard, and yet the media can also make things happen that wouldn't otherwise. I know that when I went home, I decided to look at the law, and I had sat in on trials of Greenham women, and maybe we were going to go there next. Did you have any question about that? Or?
Well, because I think it seems an important part of what you write is how the court then becomes the stage and almost like a theater event where these different positions are argued and articulated. I wonder what are your comments on what was the sort of power relation that was visible in the presentations?
It was visible. It was. It blew my mind when I went to court and watched these women, because there they were standing up defending themselves. I mean, it was just a chaotic scene. It was almost like Monty Python. It was just bizarre, like some big farce. And then I, as an American person, wasn't used to seeing, you know, I mean, I had been to court before, but I had seen old white guys sitting up there as a judge and so on, but not all of them up there with the black gown and the white wigs. And so I suppose it struck me even more than it would an English person. But so there were these extremes. I mean, these rigid white guys in their white wigs and black robes, and it was like both a scene out of Monty Python, and I think I spoke about Virginia Woolf talking about the outsider society, the fact that the quote about, as a woman I want no country, as a woman I have no country, as a woman my country is the whole world. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, we heard from Greenham women, and the media talked about it. But the trials were just wonderfully, wonderfully wild, and the women were interrupting everything, yelling, chaotic, protesting, and I mean, these judges could not control it. They did not, and I thought, you know, seems to me in an American court, they would like put them in chains and take them out. They would not ever put up with that kind of chaos and outrageous behavior, but it just kept going. And so it was obvious to me the women were much more in control than the judges were and the barristers. So I loved that, and that was really inspiring. And of course, they were being prosecuted for ironically disturbing the peace and disorderly conduct and those kinds of things.
And there's a question that I often encountered in relation to this camp being all just exclusively a women's mm-hmm. camp. And although it began as a march from Cardiff, which I think had 16 women and 4 men, but in the end, the men were really excluded.
Yeah.
And it was very clear that the wish was to establish and to communicate that very clearly, that it is exclusively a women's protest.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, what's your interpretation of that decision? What do you think what was achieved by making it exclusively for women, by women?
I think it was tough at that time for women coming to feminism in whatever form, because I think these women had done this action led by Ann Pettit, and I think they didn't want to be co-opted and they didn't want to be taken over, which happens often when men enter the scene, and especially back then, 30 years ago. And so it was very difficult to be a woman, women-only group, and there was a lot of organizing by women at that time, women artists too. You know, we organized cooperative galleries in New York and Chicago and here in Paris, Des Femmes. There were women-only groups organizing all over. Why? Because we could not exhibit, we could not participate in men's groups and men's, I mean, I did not show with a male artist for probably a dozen years you know, from the time I got out of graduate school in 79, I couldn't get into any shows with men. Of course, my work was pretty political and pretty angry, but we were excluded, and it was very difficult. And so if women organized something, they wanted it women only, because that was the only place we could participate and exhibit and gather.
But I thought that that's a slightly different case, because that this decision of really making it, at least from what I've read, was also related to the fact that what the protest was about. It is also about trying to prevent war.
Yeah.
And historically, men go to war.
Yeah.
And women True. Stay at home. And here it was this reversal, that it was women who were really fighting to prevent the war so that men didn't have to go to war, I suppose. And it was men having to actually be excluded from that process and stay at home and maintain the household.
You're so right, that's right
that
too.
I thought it was like quite an, well, another the creative way of thinking of, you know, biopolitics. I mean, obviously biopolitics is something that we would use this term now and not necessarily then, but that these processes are all connected, and that that decision was really also commenting on, you know, how history is kind of represented men in this, and how, you know, men did and still do make that history of war.
Yes, yes, that's right.
I wanted to, before you maybe tell us more about what we're going to see, I sort of wanted to bring Hannah Arendt into this, because it's also in the connection to human rights. But for me, it's also this, what she writes in her famous book, Human Condition, which is from, I think, 1956, is she proposes these two ways of thinking about life. And I think that's very, very relevant for artists. So one is the contemplative life, which she calls the vita contemplativa, and then there is the vita activa, so it's the, you know, active life. And I think that there is, for me, this kind of brings together these two ideas, or these two ways of being. They converge in a work of an artist, and I would say you would be one of those artists that I would propose probably having kind of both this kind of intellectual discourse, the documentary, the films that you make, which are both for context, which are, well, art context, film context, but there is also your engagement in the Clemency Project, and you as an artist, as a part of a kind of larger community, and as a citizen. So you're taking this kind of the active life into another dimension by being much more directly also involved with those issues. I don't know whether that makes sense.
Yes.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
I think, the one quote that I always remember from Hannah Arendt is something about freedom means access to the public sphere and the opportunity to really act in the public sphere and have a voice in the public sphere and be heard in the public sphere. I think that I took, you know, I did take a lot of what I learned from that Greenham experience and writing about it and thinking about it and conceptualizing how it was an artwork into my subsequent work. It certainly plays a huge part in the trajectory of my thinking and work. And the project that I took on in Michigan, where I live now, in terms of the Clemency Project. And so did those trials that I sat in on at Greenham, because I came home and wanted to go to Detroit and see who the women are that are being tried now, or in the U.S. at the time, for disturbing the peace and disorderly conduct. And who was it? It was street prostitutes. And that was an interesting connection that began to connect for, and you know, connect a lot of things, like the fact that lesbians and prostitutes and women who've been battered and raped and had abortions, we all get, were or have been punished by the state for those experiences. And I realized the most sort of stigmatized, silenced in some ways, are the prostitutes, the street women. And that's who I began to connect with in Detroit, and interview and document and film with. And then, and from there I moved into the prison.
Now, I wonder if, because I think whether either you'd like to say something about the films that we're going to see, or are there questions, should we leave questions for after the films, or are there any questions now that we should try and open up? Anything related to Greenham more specifically?
I was wondering if two terms that you used might be unfamiliar or kind of Americanisms or too close to your work for other people to understand. Does a younger generation that has cell phones everywhere understand what a telephone tree is?
No.
Ah. Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, it's just the idea.
So if I picture a tree,
yeah,
all
yeah,
over it. But what you mean is a list. Okay, so I call you, and you have a list of 10 people, and then each one of them has a list of 10 people, and it opens up into, that's before the internet, and how you might get word out.
Yeah. So kind of Facebook, but,
right,
you know, by phone.
And the other thing was, I think it previews getting into your films and who the subjects of your films are, but you threw out the word Black Widow in a way that I think might have just, like, what did you mean by that?
Yes, that's a spider who kills its mate.
Right,
and
but the
that's what, and a lot
their
of
the films are about women,
yes,
who their,
women who killed their partners. Because
so you mentioned that the press characterized those women when you were talking about bad press that women had at Greenham.
Yeah.
Saying similarly, they had very bad press for the women, the very women you were trying to defend or you were trying to represent.
Yeah.
Because they had killed in self-defense and were characterized by the press as
black widows.
Just
yes. Yes, by the prosecutors that would be interviewed, because they would interview me about these women's cases, because I work on their cases with lawyers, and I testify for them, and I go to court, and I go to public hearings and parole hearings and speak with them and for them and beside them, and then the press goes to the prosecutor and he calls them all kinds of scary names and says she shouldn't be let out of prison, she's, you know, a danger forever, she's going to be a mass murderer,
and
so
Black Widows is a shortening for a killer because of the spider,
yeah,
and not because of a race thing. So
right.
Just
yes. Good.
That
thank.
There,
yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's right. That's right. It was. It's a reference to the Black Widow spider,
which may be just an American continent. I don't really know.
I don't
it's
know.
The one poisonous.
Have you
spider.
Heard of Black Widow spiders? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it used as a metaphor for this kind of killings. No?
Yeah.
I've heard it before.
Yeah.
I've got a question that's kind of related to something that Manisha asked earlier to do with art and activism and how it's quite difficult to operate as an artist working like in the realm of activism. So what's been your experience? I'm just interested throughout your career, whether things have changed or the system's been more accommodating, or whether maybe perhaps if something is accommodated, it then becomes nullified, or the relationship between the art world and what you do. Really.
Yeah. I think it's still hard. I think, of course, the mainstream art world is not very welcoming to really heavy politicized work. And the irony is that I do have a New York gallery. I was for years in a feminist co-op nonprofit space in New York for many, many years, and I still am affiliated with them. But I also am in a commercial gallery, although I'm a charity case, because my work is films and work that doesn't sell. But it's always co-sponsored by Amnesty International, and my film screenings in New York are too. So they bring in another audience to the gallery and expands the gallery's audience. So, but it is a balancing act between the activism, because it is heavy duty working at grassroots level with women in prison. And I work primarily with lifers trying to get them out. And mentally ill women who are being abused in the prison. And so that sometimes eats me alive. And yet I really need to be part of the art world. And I'm teaching, and that is a balance. I think sometimes I'd have a really hard time doing the sort of gut level activism that I do am doing without that other. It's sort of like I explained with the Greenham versus the military, what struck me about the war machine and the cemeteries. And so it's a constant balancing too between activism and the art. And yet for me it's all integrated, because I do teach about it, teach human rights and women in prison and activist art. So it is integrated in my, but it's also somewhat back and forth too. And I write, so yeah, it takes many forms. But I see it as my art, all of it, really. And I think that's also what Greenham gave me, a sense of, that fact that it is all, as long as I'm pushing boundaries and pushing on the state and pushing and creating something that, as you have talked about, maybe not making something but making things happen, and trying to make things happen that are important to us, that's what art is too.
It reminds me, it just reminds me of the artist placement group that John Latham set up in the 70s, where he placed artists within industries in the UK. And it was this idea that the artist's role should be really integrated into society, and the artist has a particular insight. And maybe a particular commission, which other workers might not have, and I find that idea really interesting, but maybe also problematic. I'm not quite sure. It's a really interesting idea.
And I tell students, go out there, and if you're, and you'll be an artist if you're a wrench in the machine instead of part of it. Yeah.
Well, then we must read this Doris Lessing beginning, which is an answer maybe to this tension. It says, artists are traditional interpreters of dreams and nightmares, and this is no time to turn our backs on our chosen responsibilities, which is what we would be doing if we refused to share in the deep anxieties, terrors, and hopes of human beings everywhere. What is the choice before us? Is it not merely a question of preventing evil, but of strengthening a vision of a good which may defeat the evil? So, you know, that idea of responsibility and engagement, and I suppose, you know, that means engagement with what you care about. Now, the kind of forms that takes is a different story. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, you know, unless you are invested in something that has a place in the real world, you only operate in the art world. And that's not so interesting. And also, it's very often out of your control once your kind of production enters the art world. So I think, you know, there are these ways in which artists also trying to address different audiences. Mm-hmm. So by going to the artist placement group, which was John Latham and Barbara Steveni, that's important to mention, is that, you know, they really tried to reconfigure the relationship between what can be seen as art. And even though, you know, I've seen there are projects that never resulted in anything durable, but the fact that these people spent 2 years, you know, at the British Coal Board or British Rail or, you know, any of these things meant that there was an introduction of an artist into an environment where most people would think that artists simply paint. Uh-huh. So I think, you know, that my experience of, you know, an artist is really often an agent and a kind of conduit for these kind of questions, which otherwise, you know, they are not addressed, or they're addressed by journalists. Mm-hmm. And that's a very different role as well. Let's move on to what we're going to see.
Okay, I am going to show you first just a piece of a film called Clemency. Most of my films are narrated by women in prison or just out of prison or just out of jail. And Clemency is a piece that I use primarily as a recruiting tool. It educates lawyers and judges and students. These are women who are serving life. And then I'm going to show...
And what year is this made in?
This one was made in 98 or something. So
98, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this piece is, and a lot of my, I mean, I can't, I think I came back and made a lot of work about that was out of my anger, and then I think with the prison work, it is what I want to see in the world. It is the women's voices that we don't usually hear or see. Clemency means it's an act of the governor and it can to release and of the state, in our case the governor of the state, to grant mercy, to grant pardon to a person who's serving a life or a long sentence, and it usually grants them a release on time served. So instead of dying in prison, it is what we're after for these women who are serving life and would otherwise die in prison. Given that the U.S. is so punitive. Now let's see, hopefully we
can. So that's
get
the first film?
So this is, Clemency is the title.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are we seeing two films or just
we're seeing a clip from this one and then a film. Okay. Yeah, a 13-minute film after that. This will be just for a few minutes.